Lecture 12, The Real X-Files, Conspiracy Theories in Myth and Reality. A central theme of this course is that conspiracy theories are true often enough that it is not unwise of us to be constructively conspiracists about people and organizations with power. It's a reality well documented by the historian Catherine Olmsted in her 2009 book, Real Enemies, Conspiracy Theories in American Democracy, World War I to 9/11, which I introduced in Lecture 2. Before the First World War, says Olmsted, conspiracy theories were mostly directed toward religious, ethnic, and racial minorities, especially Jews, driven largely by fears that these outsiders were conspiring to use the government to their own end. After World War I, says Olmsted, no longer were conspiracy theorists chiefly concerned that alien forces were plotting to capture the federal government. Instead, they proposed that the federal government itself was the conspirator. Here is how Olmsted characterizes the difference between conspiracy theories pre-World War I from those that came after. The institutionalized secrecy of the modern U.S. government inspired a new type of conspiracy theories. These theories argued that government officials lied to citizens, dragged the peaceable American people into foolish wars, and then spied on and oppressed the opponents of war. Inasmuch as agencies of the United States government did do these things, it was not unreasonable for citizens to become skeptical of their own government. Examples are legion throughout the 20th century. For instance, the Pentagon Papers revealed to what extent the federal government was lying to and spying on its citizens during the years of the Vietnam War. As discussed in an earlier lecture, these efforts included the FBI wiretapping Martin Luther King Jr., even recording his extramarital trysts and trying to blackmail him into silence, which didn't work. So, his assassination in 1968 by a lone assassin named James Earl Ray looked quite suspicious, as did the murder that same year of Robert Kennedy. As with Robert's brother, JFK, no conspiracies were ever proven in these assassinations. But the point here is that it was not unreasonable for a great many people to suspect that there was. Then there was Watergate and Richard Nixon's secret audio tapes that exposed the public to the uglier side of mainstream politics and politicians in all their racist and bigoted conspiratorial mongering, particularly the president's suspicions of Jews. Under Nixon's administration, says Olmsted, paranoia, conspiracy, and conspiracy theory became fundamental operating principles of the executive branch. In fact, Nixon withheld vital information from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, so in response, they had a National Security Council staffer steal documents from Secretary of State Henry Kissinger's briefcase so that they would know what was really going on in the administration. So the government was spying on itself. In 1975, the CIA's secret and illegal program, MKUltra, was exposed by the Church Committee of Congress, showing that since the 1950s, the agency had engaged in mind control experiments involving LSD and other drugs on unsuspecting people with an aim toward developing drugs and procedures that could be used in interrogations. One of these unwitting victims was a U.S. Army biochemist named Frank Olson, who fell out of a New York hotel window to his death. His son, Eric Olson, has long suspected that the CIA murdered his father in a gripping docudrama series produced by the acclaimed filmmaker Earl Morris titled Wormwood, ends by playing out two possible scenarios, suicide and murder. A 1994 autopsy report on Olson's exhumed body suggested that cranial injuries might have happened before his fall, meaning he was knocked out first. But the government never admitted homicidal guilt, and instead paid the Olson family $750,000 for the lack of informed consent for the LSD experiment. Either way, that the CIA was dosing unsuspecting citizens with mind-altering drugs is all we need to know to understand why people believe conspiracy theories. The Iran-Contra scandal under President Ronald Reagan in the 1980s further eroded public trust in what the U.S. government was doing without the approval of Congress, much less its own citizens. Senior administration officials secretly facilitated the sale of arms to Iran, which was illegal at the time because of an arms embargo. The proceeds from the illegal sale were used to fund the Contras in Nicaragua, perceived to be more favorable to American interests in that they were fighting the socialist government. Supporting such rebel groups was prohibited by Congress. As Olmsted notes, Iran-Contra represented what conspiracy theorists since the First World War had feared the most, the ultimate executive usurpation of power. The Iran-Contra conspirators had not subverted the government, they were the government. By the late 1980s, presidential and congressional approval ratings were in freefall, leading Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan to observe that never in the history of the nation had there been so massive a hemorrhaging of trust and integrity. This lack of trust and transparency leads to conspiratorial thinking. By the time the television series X-Files aired in the 1990s, many of their otherwise patently absurd plots involving cigarette-smoking men in back rooms running the world aided by extraterrestrial overlords didn't seem so ridiculous to many Americans, and the show became a gigantic hit. The problem for discerning true from false conspiracy theories is that governments do lie and cover up. A case in point is the X-Files' most popular conspiracy theories involving UFOs, particularly Roswell and Area 51. Our story begins on June 14, 1947, when a rancher working just outside Roswell, New Mexico, named William W. Mac Brazel, discovered some unusual debris scattered on the ground. On July 7th, Brazel notified the local sheriff saying he might have discovered the remains of one of them flying saucers. The reference was to a wave of UFO sightings that began on June 24, 1947, when a man named Kenneth Arnold was flying his private plane over the Cascade Mountains in Washington State and saw nine shiny objects moving quickly across the sky. Arnold initially described them as flying like geese in formation, which is probably what it was. I've seen such UFOs myself. But then later added that the objects were crescent-shaped and that they moved like a saucer would if you skipped it across the water. An Associated Press story about the incident then misquoted Arnold as describing what he saw as flying saucers. Later, Arnold complained, "They said I said they were saucer-like. I said they flew in saucer-like fashion." Nevertheless, the flying saucer meme caught on as the Associated Press story was picked up by over 150 newspapers, and soon after, hundreds of flying saucer reports appeared, with a peak of 850 sightings in the weeks following Arnold's report. The July 7 story told by Mac Brazel promptly reached the Roswell Army Airfield, RAAF, at which point a lieutenant named Walter Hout sent out a press release stating that a flying disc had been recovered at the ranch. Hout, in fact, had not seen the debris himself. So here begins the distortion of the most famous UFO case in history, the Roswell incident. The incident, in fact, has nothing to do with extraterrestrial intelligence and everything to do with terrestrial surveillance. The following day, July 8, 1947, the Roswell Daily Record ran this now famous headline, RAAF Captures Flying Saucer on Ranch in Roswell Region. The next day, July 9, the Roswell Daily Record offered a more sobering description of what was found on the ranch. Quote, "When the debris was gathered up, the tinfoil, paper, tape, and sticks made a bundle about 3 feet long and 7 or 8 inches thick, while the rubber made a bundle about 18 or 20 inches long and about 8 inches thick. In all, Razzle estimated, the entire lot would have weighed maybe 5 pounds. The military described the debris as the remains of a weather balloon, and that was that for the next 30 years, as Roswell disappeared from UFO cultural radar. In fact, in 1967, a pro-UFOlogist named Ted Bleeker published a report titled UFO Wave of 1947, which chronicled 853 UFO reports. Roswell wasn't even on the list. Think about that. The most famous UFO case in history wasn't even on the radar screen of ufologists at the time it happened and the 20 years after. Roswell, then, is really a story of modern myth-making, starting in the 1970s with documentaries like UFOs Are Real, then solidified when Charles Berlitz and William L. Moore published The Roswell Incident, a bestseller that outlined a government cover-up of the discovery of a crashed alien spacecraft in the New Mexico desert. Shortly thereafter, other bestsellers appeared, such as Kevin Randall's UFO Crash at Roswell. And since then, thousands of articles, books, television shows, and the like have kept the Roswell myth alive. Here's what really happened. The debris discovered at the ranch in Roswell was not the remains of a weather balloon, as reported by the military. It was the debris from the crash of an experimental high-altitude spy balloon designed to detect acoustic signatures of Soviet nuclear bomb tests in the upper atmosphere, part of a program called Project Mogul. In 1994, Charles B. Moore, a Project Mogul scientist, was even able to identify which specific spy balloon it was, called NYU Flight 4. Here's Moore in his own words, quote, "When the wind information is coupled with the similarities in the debris described by the eyewitnesses, the balsal sticks, the tin foil, the tape with pastel, pinkish-purple flowers, the smoky gray balloon rubber with a burnt odor, the eyelets, the tough paper, the 4-inch diameter aluminum pieces, and the black box, to the material used in our balloon flight trains, it appears to me that it would be difficult to exclude NYU Flight 4 as a likely source of the debris that W.W. Brazel found in 1947. UFOlogists make much of the fact that the government lied about what happened at Roswell, calling it a weather balloon instead of a surveillance balloon. But they're mistaking military secrets for UFO evidence. This was the Cold War, and the U.S. government was understandably disinclined to publicly announce that it was carrying on surveillance of the Soviet nuclear program. Area 51 is even more shrouded in mystery, inasmuch as it has long been a top-secret military facility that precludes UFOlogists, curious journalists, and skeptics like me from poking around inside to find out what is really going on at this dry lake bed 90 miles north of Las Vegas. It wasn't until 2013 that a Freedom of Information Act request resulted in the CIA revealing to the public for the first time what Area 51 was for. In 1955, the government constructed a long runway on the dry lake bed in order to conduct test flights of the U-2 spy plane, a high-altitude aircraft equipped with high-resolution cameras to record military activities in the Soviet Union and its allies, such as Cuba. After Francis Gary Powers' U-2 was shot down over the Soviet Union, the CIA launched Project Oxcart, another top-secret program, to develop the next generation of spy planes, Lockheed's A-12, which eventually became the legendary SR-71 Blackbird. Keep in mind that these planes are fast, traveling at over 2,000 miles per hour, and they fly at altitudes 3 times higher than commercial airliners, soaring as high as 90,000 feet. With over 2,850 Oxcart A-12 flights alone at Area 51 and surrounding territory, it's no wonder there were so many UFO sightings that even experienced commercial pilots found baffling and mysterious. As one Area 51 veteran explained, quote, "The shape of Oxcart was unprecedented, with its wide, disc-like fuselage designed to carry vast quantities of fuel. Commercial pilots cruising over Nevada at dusk would look up and see the bottom of Oxcart whiz by at 2,000-plus miles per hour. The aircraft's titanium body, moving as fast as a bullet, would reflect the sun's rays in a way that could make anyone think UFO." As amusing as such conspiracy theories can be, they're relatively harmless grist for television screenwriters and ufologists meeting in hotel conference rooms. Other conspiracies are far more disturbing, even deadly. Consider an extremely troubling example from 20th century history. My example begins at the Nuremberg trials of Nazi criminals shortly after the end of the Second World War, when their crimes against humanity were exposed. Starting in the mid-1930s, when they sterilized tens of thousands of Germans decreed to be subject to such hereditary diseases as feeble-mindedness, schizophrenia, and epilepsy. Part of their defense was to point to America as a precedent for their sterilization program. In the early 20th century, so-called feeble-minded Americans, those at the bottom of the intellectual ladder in the newly developed field of intelligence testing, were believed to be draining the gene pool and pulling the country down. Eugenic policy at the time called for sterilization, and from 1907 to 1928, almost 9,000 Americans were sterilized. The most famous case was that of a woman named Carrie Buck, who lived along with her mother in Virginia's Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded. Yes, there was really a place in America with that title. Carrie and her mother were both classified as feeble-minded. Carrie soon gave birth to an illegitimate daughter, and since the science of the day dictated that 3 successive generations of feeble-mindedness constituted evidence of hereditary cause, it was determined that Carrie should be sterilized. That decision was challenged and went to the Virginia Supreme Court, where it was upheld in 1925. Challenged again, the case was argued before the United States Supreme Court, where the justices voted in favor of sterilization. Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes passed judgment on Carrie Buck with these chilling words, quote, "It is better for all the world if instead of waiting to execute degenerate offspring for crime or to let them starve for their imbecility, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind. The principle that sustains compulsory vaccination is broad enough to cover cutting the fallopian tubes. 3 generations of imbeciles are enough." Carrie Buck was sterilized, along with 1,000 others at the Virginia Colony, pushing the total in America to about 20,000 sterilizations by the mid-1930s, most without their knowledge or consent. That's a conspiracy. Thus far in this lecture, I have focused primarily on political and military conspiracies and conspiracy theories, but let's not let big business off the conspiratorial hook. I shall start this section with a question. What do tobacco, food additives, chemical flame retardants, and carbon emissions all have in common? The answer is that the industries associated with them have been disturbingly effective at planting doubt in the mind of the public in the teeth of scientific evidence. It's a type of conspiracy inasmuch as these industries knew about the harmful effects of their products on unsuspecting customers and conspired to cover up that information. It began with the tobacco industry when scientific evidence began to mount that cigarettes cause lung cancer. A 1969 memo included this statement from an executive at the Brown & Williamson Tobacco Company. "Doubt is our product, since it is the best means of competing with the body of fact that exists in the minds of the general public." For decades, the tobacco industry conspired to deceive the public on the health dangers of cigarettes. In 1999, the Justice Department sued tobacco companies for racketeering, seeking to force them to pay for their decades of deception. In 2006, U.S. District Judge Gladys Kessler ruled against them, noting in a scathing opinion, quote, "Defendants have known many of these facts for 50 years or more. Despite that knowledge, they have consistently, repeatedly, and with enormous skill and sophistication, denied these facts to the public. Moreover, in order to sustain the economic viability of their companies, defendants have denied that they marketed and advertised their products to children under the age of 18 in order to ensure an adequate supply of replacement smokers as older ones fall by the wayside through death, illness, or cessation of smoking. In short, defendants have marketed and sold their lethal product with zeal, with deception, with a single-minded focus on their financial success, and without regard for the human tragedy or social costs that success exacted." The tobacco model was subsequently mimicked by other industries. As Peter Sparber, a veteran tobacco lobbyist, said, "If you can do tobacco, you can do just about anything in public relations." It was as if they were all working from the same playbook, employing such tactics as deny the problem, minimize the problem, call for more evidence, shift the blame, cherry-pick the data, shoot the messenger, attack alternatives, hire industry-friendly scientists, create front groups. The documentary filmmaker Robert Kenner encountered this last strategy while shooting his 2008 film, Food, Inc., about harmful chemicals and preservatives in the food we eat. "I kept bumping into groups like Center for Consumer Freedom that were doing everything in their power to keep us from knowing what's in our food." Kenner calls them Orwellian because such front groups sound like neutral nonprofit think tanks in search of scientific truth, but are in fact funded by the for-profit industries associated with the problems they investigate. Consider Citizens for Fire Safety, a front group created and financed in part by chemical and tobacco companies to address the problem of home fires started by cigarettes. Kenner found them while filming his 2014 film, Merchants of Doubt, a film in which I appeared as an expert witness. To misdirect regulators and the public away from the link between cigarettes and home fires, the tobacco industry hired lobbyist Peter Sparber, the tobacco lobbyist mentioned earlier, to work with the National Association of State Fire Marshals to promote the use of chemical flame retardants in furniture. As another leaked memo reads, "You have to fireproof the world around the cigarette." Suddenly, Americans' furniture was awash in toxic chemicals. Climate change is the latest arena for these merchants of conspiracism, and the front group du jour is ClimateDepot.com, financed in part by Chevron and Exxon, and headed by a colorful character named Mark Morano, who told Kenner, "I'm not a scientist, but I do play one on TV occasionally. Well, more than occasionally." Murano's motto to challenge climate science, about which he admits he has no scientific training, is keep it short, keep it simple, keep it funny. Manufacturing doubt is not difficult because in science, all conclusions are provisional, and skepticism is intrinsic to the process. But as historian of science Naomi Oreskes notes, just because we don't know everything, that doesn't mean we know nothing. We know a lot, in fact, and it is what we know that some people don't want us to know that is at the heart of the problem. What can we do about this form of conspiracism? Magicians have a saying reiterated in Merchants of Doubt by close-up prestidigitator Jamie Ian Swiss, once revealed, never concealed. On film, Swiss demonstrates it with a card trick in which a selected card that goes back into the deck ends up beneath a drinking glass on the table. It is virtually impossible to see how it's done, but once the move is highlighted in a second viewing, it is virtually impossible not to see it thereafter. My hope with this form of corporate conspiracism, which has obvious political implications when it comes to big issues like climate change, is to expose the conspiracy for what it really is and hope the tricks of these magicians of doubt are no longer effective. To close this course on conspiracies and conspiracy theories, I want to touch on two new types of conspiracism, both involving social media. The first involves the new Chinese program of social credits based on citizens' behavior, favorable or unfavorable toward the government, with better or worse social consequences, such as the availability of schools, travel, and jobs. Here's how it works. A private social credit program run by Alibaba, the Chinese equivalent of Google, operates like a voluntary loyalty scheme that monitors customer trustworthiness through online behavior and credit history, in which high scores accrued for purchasing the right products, such as diapers, result in such benefits as low-interest loans, preferential access to ride-sharing programs, free healthcare checkups, and fast-track visa applications for international travel. Purchasing less favorable products, such as alcohol, can result in a loss of such benefits. Public social credit programs have been initiated by dozens of Chinese cities in which red lists are constructed of citizens whose behavior is deemed trustworthy, such as helping neighbors, rewarded through lower taxes. Untrustworthy citizens, for example, those who don't pay their taxes, smoke in non-smoking zones, or commit minor legal infractions like jaywalking, purchasing too much alcohol, or speaking out against the government, received reduced government assistance, such as welfare programs, or are ineligible for employment in the public sector. Chinese citizens who are blacklisted are ineligible from purchasing airline tickets, property, and high-speed internet access. There are reports that millions of Chinese citizens have already been banned from flying or taking trains because of low social credit scores. Although still limited in scope, the plan is to bring the program online for all Chinese citizens in the early 2020s, very likely reducing the civil liberties of a people already suffering from one of the most oppressive governments in the world. While it is too soon to know if this will devolve into a chapter out of a dystopian novel or an episode of the dark science fiction television series Black Mirror, clearly, the potential for autocratic control through advanced technology is there and not something to be overlooked in the West as the power of social media increases and companies like Facebook, Twitter, and Google ramp up their own data collection of everything we do online. A second type of new conspiracism has been identified by the political scientists Russell Muirhead and Nancy L. Rosenblum for their 2019 book, A Lot of People Are Saying, The New Conspiracism and the Assault on Democracy. Classic conspiracy theories are grounded in arguments and evidence, whereas more recent conspiracy theories are simply asserted usually without facts to support them. This new conspiracism is captured in the book's title, ripped from the 2016 presidential election, and Donald Trump's recurrent phrase, "A lot of people are saying," which was typically followed by no evidence whatsoever for the assertion. As Muirhead and Rosenblum explain, the new conspiracism, quote, "There is no punctilious demand for proofs, no exhausting amassing of evidence, no dots revealed to form a pattern, no close examination of the operators plotting in the shadows. The new conspiracism dispenses with the burden of explanation. Instead, we have innuendo and verbal gesture, a lot of people are saying, or we have bare assertion, rigged. This is conspiracy theory without the theory." How does such conspiracism spread and catch hold then? Repetition. In the age of social media, what counts is not evidence so much as retweets, reposts, and likes. And by no means is the new conspiracism the product only of President Trump, given that politicians, not to mention economists, scholars, pundits, and ideologues of all stripes, have been making evidence-lacking assertions for generations, although admittedly without an audience of 60 million Twitter followers the current conspiracist-in-chief commands. More importantly, Trump's conspiratorial assertions would go nowhere without a receptive audience. So the blame for the nefarious effects of the new conspiracism have to be spread much wider to encompass all social media, alternative media, and even some mainstream media, which have stepped up their sensationalistic headlines in an effort to recapture advertising dollars they've been losing since the rise of the internet. Most disturbing of all for the spread of conspiracy theories are internet trolls and bots giving the false impression that there are far more adherents to a particular conspiracy theory than there actually are. This is called pluralistic ignorance, or the spiral of silence, in which everyone believes that everyone else believes something, even when very few people do. When everyone in the group thinks this way, an idea that most individual members do not endorse can take hold of a group. Fortunately, there's a way to break the bonds of pluralistic ignorance: knowledge and transparency. Sociologist Michael Macy, for example, found that when skeptics are scattered among true believers in a computer simulation of a society in which there is ample opportunity for interaction and communication, social connectedness acted as a safeguard against the takeover of unpopular norms. Knowledge and transparency are the keys to combating both conspiracies and conspiracy theories, including the new conspiracism. Free inquiry, free speech, and especially a free press are vital to the stability of a liberal democracy, one in which all citizens have access to all available knowledge, and politicians must operate under a transparent dome with all of us looking in to ensure that conspiracies do not corrupt society and that conspiracy theories do not corrupt society absolutely. I am confident that through knowledge and transparency, the conspiracies and conspiracy theories of today, like those of the past, will be revealed for what they are, and that our civilization will continue its long path of moral progress, the arc of the moral universe continuing to bend toward truth, justice, and freedom.